Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Bhutang dhammang sanghang namassami. I have a lot of gratitude for teachers like Ajahn Pasano, Ajahn Amaro, others who have to speak Dhamma on a regular basis. It's amazing that they keep finding things to talk about. That takes some getting used to as well. And I remember as a novice thinking, can't wait till I'm a senior monk and tell everybody. And, it's like get really nervous. And So I wanted to start by there was a question last night about what was done with the remains of the monk who was cremated in Thailand, and I think that was maybe a question about Thanjyoti Panyo. I was not sure, but just thought I would address that briefly. And so that was one part was put inside of a little sandstone shrine that was made and put in the cave where he passed away with his age, 39 years old, and a Dhammapada quote underneath it, which is quite nice. And it was better it is to live a single day with mindfulness and concentration and wisdom than it is to live for 100 years without mindfulness and concentration and wisdom. And the rest of it was the rest of the bones and ashes were taken back to Tisarana Monastery. Ajahn Viradamo happened to be in Thailand, so he then took the rest back to his monastery and then presented the remains to the mother. So when we're practicing, it's during this retreat, it's more of a focused time of practice, and things arise in the awareness. And sometimes it can seem like we're lost or listen to teachings and trying to understand but don't quite understand. And it brings to mind for me the first sutta in the Samyutta Nikaya, at Devata asking some questions of the Buddha responding. And so the Devata asking, how did you cross the flood? Meaning the flood of attachment, desire, clinging. And the Buddha responds by saying, by not standing still and by not moving forward, that's how I cross the flood. And then the Devata says, what is standing? What do you mean by not standing still, by not moving forward? The Buddha says, when I stood still, I sunk. When I moved forward, I was swept away. Therefore, by not standing still, by not moving forward, that's how I cross the flood. And so it doesn't say it there, but what the Buddha did was he built a raft and crossed on a raft, and the raft is the Noble Eightfold Path. So when we come to practice, then before us there's this incredible flood in the heart, the flood of attachment, desire, craving. And it's not to really be seen in a negative way. When the Buddha taught the Four Noble Truths, saying that there's sensual desire, becoming, and the desire for not becoming, the desire for annihilation, these aren't character judgments, but these are just the causes of suffering made clear. And we can't really see them as self-judgment or character judgments, because the very reason we were born and exist is because of attachment and craving. And so it's important not to take that ideal of original sin and try to apply it to the Buddhist teachings, like, I was born a bad person, and so there's no hope for me. And so it's important not to see it in that negative light, and also hearing the teachings, then not to take them too personally, but to apply them as skillful means. So Lungpo was talking about mid-retreat, talking about guilt and how he was translating for Lungpo Panyananda, trying to convey this idea of what guilt is. And myself, I'm no stranger to this feeling. And even though my parents didn't bring me up going to church, and I've never been to Mass before, still it's ingrained in the culture, and you could still say I have a Judeo-Christian upbringing, just because it's so ingrained in the culture, the way we relate to ourselves and others. And this feeling of, this idea of guilt is huge in the culture, because you have like courts and judges and guilty or not guilty, and it's just an idea that's really ingrained. And it's really difficult to say what it is, but I think what it is it's an incredibly complex and masked form of self-hatred. And it's kind of, there's so many layers to it that it's difficult to see it that way. But I think it's important to investigate that guilt and to see it for what it is. And then to have the courage to question it or to go against it. That's saddha is translated as faith, but it also means courage. So to have faith, to have courage to take a leap of faith and question that feeling if it arises. And I think a good practice is when you're by yourself sometime, maybe before you go to bed, or at some point when nobody else is around, then just try saying out loud, I don't hate myself. And you just say it out loud and see what happens. I don't hate myself. I refuse to hate myself. And just to put that out there and actually say it out loud and see what happens. And so that might shed light on a lot of things that are hidden, a lot of blind spots in the mind. And the change can actually be quite dramatic, and suddenly a sense of well-being and contentment that we've never really known before, or maybe we knew it when we were a small child, might well up in the heart. And so if that happens, it can be quite dramatic and quite an eye-opener. And that can be a good starting point for the path. But we have to be careful if we do have experiences like that, because the old habits will come back to visit. And if we're not careful, they can take over again. We can go back into our old habits. So we have to have mindfulness and to be very aware of what's happening. But if we do give rise to that contentment and ease and well-being, then that's a good starting point, because then we can sit back and take stock of things and see more clearly. So it's important to be lighthearted. We might have a feeling of lightness in the body and mind. And the body and mind are connected, so whatever happens in the mind, that's having an effect in the body. It can be really subtle. That's why in meditation we can focus on our meditation object, for example, the breath, but also we can focus on consciously calming the body, consciously calming the face and the hands and the shoulders. So that can have an effect on the mind. So when we have that contentment, ease, well-being, and we're practicing, and can be quite enjoyable, and then we can take a look at the path, we can do some investigation. A lot of people here, from judging from the questions, have been investigating anatta. And all of these teachings are the Dhamma put into words, although ultimately you can't really put experience into words. But there has to be a relative path, there has to be a labeling of things to guide us somehow to the deathless. So the Buddha said the Noble Eightfold Path is the highest of all conditioned things, because it's a conditioned thing that we follow in order to reach the unconditioned. And so in that sense, it's a very sacred path. And there's many ways to look at it. You can look at the Noble Eightfold Path as Sila, Samadhi, Panya, precepts, meditation, wisdom. That's one breakdown of it. You can look at it as the seven factors of enlightenment. You can look at it as the 10 paramitas. So all the teachings are connected. And different people like to look at them in different ways. So even though it doesn't occur directly in the suttas, I like the breakdown of the 10 paramitas, because this is something that you can apply whatever you're doing in daily life, or if you're focusing more on the formal meditation, you can always think of the practice as cultivating the 10 paramitas. Because we have to have a really broad idea of what the practice is when we come to take precepts and we decide we're going to commit our life to have a Dhamma practice. And we have to be careful in how we go about that practice, or how we view that Dhamma practice, because we might come to it with an idea that to practice Dhamma you have to ordain as a monk and only meditate all the time, and that's practice, or that's the real practice, or you have to go to a cave and only meditate, or you have to do some sort of extreme thing in order to practice. It's a very rare person that can just ordain and then meditate all the time. So we need to balance our practice, balance our life with other things, and so we can sustain it and then watch it unfold. So the word practice is a little bit difficult one too, because it's kind of this word practice is kind of makes me think of like practicing guitar or practice juggling or something. And I like to think of what we're doing more as cultivation. And people who are practicing, I like to think of them as cultivators, because really what we're doing is like farming. And we're planting seeds, planting trees, and they take a long time to grow, and we have to be really patient. And a lot of the time there's not lots of big lights and signposts in our cultivation, but we just very patiently do this gardening in the soil of the mind, and planting seeds of bodhi and taking out the weeds, which is like taking on precepts. Taking out, uprooting things that are going to hurt those seeds that we're planting. And then a lot of the time, it's just watching and waiting and watering and just nurturing those seeds. And because they're trees, they grow very, very slowly. And then once they do start coming up, we can't make them grow really fast. So we can't just go and like and pull the tree and try to make it grow faster. We just have to let it grow at its own pace. And so because it's not just about meditation, this is the 10 paramitas or something that's applied to our entire life. And so it gives us a framework. And so we have Dana Parami, which is the perfection of generosity. And it's just something to contemplate, something that we put higher than ourselves. And Dana Parami is, the Buddha would teach that as the first step to learning how to relinquish things, learning how to give up, learning how to renounce. And so we can start by giving gifts wherever we think a gift must be given. Maybe we have faith in a certain teacher, or we give to a charity, give to the homeless. But whatever we're doing, we learn how to be generous, and then we see that we can come out of ourselves based on that practice, and we feel good about it. Then there's Sila Parami. That's perfection of discipline or precepts, perfection of virtue. And when we come to take on precepts, and if we've been holding precepts for some time, we might think, you know, oh, ho-hum, I'm just a boring person holding precepts. Even, you know, my friends from high school, they just never visit the monastery because it's just really boring. There's nothing to do there. But it's good to see the precepts in the light of just the juxtaposing it with not keeping precepts. And for myself, I can really see that my life's become a lot better since keeping precepts. And I remember as a child and growing up, there's just no real guidance from the society. And my parents raised me the best I could, but also they're products of the society as well. And so there's no real guidance in virtue or precepts. And it's almost like you have to have karma from past lives in order to be truthful and not go around torching ants with hairspray and things like that. Just things that kids just did when they were bored. And or lying, like, you know, it's just like you learn very quickly as a child, I can get what I want if I just lie. And then it seems like it has a good effect until you start realizing, oh yeah, that's really looked down upon. You're not trustworthy, and people don't believe what you say. But you don't really, these effects aren't apparent when you're just a child. I remember getting my mother to call in sick at school for me because I just wanted to play video games all day. And it's like, it's something so strange to think about it now. Why would you tell a lie for something like that? So when I did start studying the Buddha's teachings after I got out of high school and I started studying about the precepts, then I did feel really bad about myself. And I think one of the questions was, you know, the more I practice, the worse I feel about myself. And I did feel that way at first. And it was more just kind of regret, but then also frustration, because then I could see with some things, like taking lying as an example again, like it's really hard actually to not ever lie and live in the world. And so I remember it was right before coming to the monastery working carpentry, and I already had a sense of not wanting to lie and wanting to keep virtue and keep precepts. And then the neighbor didn't want to see this house built, so he was trying to get delays. He was calling OSHA to get OSHA to come out and maybe put a stop to the building project. And it was ruining the neighbor's view, so he wasn't very happy about it. And And so my boss was kind of like, okay, when the OSHA guy comes, don't tell him that we're working with the skill saw guards locked up, because it's a $20,000 fine, and you just have to lie about it. And I said, okay, it seems like a small thing. And so, of course, the OSHA guy comes. And then this other guy who was working with us, who I found out later had taken a vow to never lie, he just bolted, and he never came back to the job. But for me, it still didn't feel like a big deal. So the OSHA guy came, and one of the questions he asked was, are you working with your skill saw guards locked back? And I just said no. And so my boss doesn't get a $20,000 fine. And so it's kind of a catch-22. What do you do in that situation? So I already had a plan to come to the monastery, but that's one thing that stuck with me. It's actually very difficult to not tell lies in the world. Sometimes we feel like we're forced into it. And so when the Buddha's talking about precepts, he also mentions that the punya, and the virtue that comes from keeping precepts is something that is more than we think, because it's a great gift to the entire world to be keeping precepts. If we're not killing, then we create the goodness that's related to offering fearlessness to all living beings. There's not a living being that has to think. If we take on the precept against killing, then that's one less person in the world who's going to be killing living beings, so that it's the merit of offering fearlessness on that level to all living beings. And the same with stealing. When one person takes on the precept against stealing, then it's offering that to the world. It's one more person who's not going to be taking what's not given, not going to be stealing. And it's the same with the other precepts. And so then we have Nekama Parami, which is like perfection of renunciation. Nekama, like world weariness, nibbida. But also, this isn't just for monks, because these things like sense restraint and relinquishing sensuality, these are prerequisites for deepening samadhi, for deepening meditation. And so we might focus on this Nekama Parami more when we're on a 10-day retreat, on an 8-precept retreat, and then we have a chance to turn inward and not be focusing on sights, not going around, and not listening to music, not focusing on clinging to the external world so much. So this is Nekama. In the monk's discipline, we have a minor precept which says we should keep our eyes downcast when we're in public. And that's an external manifestation or a reminder of Nekama Parami. And I remember being in India, and I was keeping this precept quite strongly at the time. And so I determined that when I was in India, I wouldn't be looking around everywhere a lot. I would be keeping my eyes down for the most part, and just playing the part of being a samana in India. And I remember being at the deer park with Manu, my Indian friend, who was attending on me, taking me around. And we were staying at a Jain rest house just outside of the deer park in Varanasi. And the man's name was also Dr. Jain, and he was Jain, him and his wife. And very nice people. And we were staying there about 5 days, the deer park, and going to the deer park each day and meditating, circumambulating the Dhammacakka Pavattana stupa there. And about the third day, because Manu was purchasing meals for me in the rest house, so in the morning times I'd eat the meal. It wasn't convenient to eat out of my bowl, because they would take plates to me, and then they would keep taking plates until I was finished eating. So I was eating off of a plate at a table. And then about the third day, they stopped accepting money from Manu, and then the mother of the household, she would sit next to me. She sat down right next to me while I was eating and was just watching me eat. And so I thought, that's kind of strange. And then as soon as my plate was finished, there was maybe five different dishes, a spread of dishes, and as soon as one type was finished, right away she'd take it away and replace it with a full one of that dish. And then whenever I didn't finish a dish, then, you know, eventually the meal was finished. But every single one, if it went empty, she'd replace it with a full one immediately. And then a couple days of that went by, and I asked Manu, what are they doing? And he said, well, that's quite interesting that she's doing that, because in Indian custom in general, specifically the Jain lay people, I guess there's a lot of Jain lay people in India, and they will only do that as far as like sitting next to the samana. They only do that for someone who they hold in the highest regard. And so then the next day, I asked Dr. Jain, they were offering tea, and I just asked him, he was telling me, he said, we can tell that you're a real samana. We want to just give you the highest treatment, hospitality we can. And I just asked him, why is that? Why do you consider me that way? And he said, well, in India, there's one thing that we look for, and as far as if somebody's a real samana, and that is, do they keep their eyes downcast? And we can see that you keep your eyes downcast, and therefore we've decided to give you the highest treatment possible. I thought that was interesting. And he also said it's incredibly rare. He said a lot of sadhus, and, you know, it's incredibly rare to see a samana with downcast eyes these days. And he related a story of a Tibetan monk who had just stayed there the week before, who was upset with him because he doesn't offer TV in his rest house. And then he related how he told that monk, but you're a monk, why do you have to watch TV? And that monk responded by saying, you're a layperson and I'm a monk, and when I watch TV, it's not the same as when you watch TV. That was priceless. it's a wrong view. Actually, we monks have bodies and minds, and lay people have bodies and minds. And karma still comes into play. So nekama parami is useful as well. And samadhi barami. And so, yeah, I already brought that up a bit in relation to nekama parami. But the Buddha has a sutta where he says, when you cultivate the way, you have to meditate again and again. Let go of attachment again and again. Let go of desire again and again. And so we meditate again and again, and that's our cultivation of samadhi parami, and we just have to be really patient. And the next one is panya parami. And so the wisdom aspect, and it's recognizing that keeping precepts and having renunciation and cultivating stillness of mind and collectedness of mind, samadhi, it's not the entire path. So wisdom and seeing things clearly is really what's going to transform us. And so during the noticing a lot of the questions around anatta, people investigating, well, what about this? Is that anatta? Or what if I'm nobody, then what? Or, you know, just looking at it from different angles. And it even comes up in the suttas too, people being perplexed by the concept of anatta and asking the Buddha, well, does my no-self see myself? Or does myself, what self sees my no-self? And, you know, looking at it in all these different ways. What receives the past actions? What receives the karma? What goes on to rebirth? If there's no self, if there's anatta, or just, well, if even the knowing is not self, then who am I? And so that's, there's no easy answer to that, but that can be a very fruitful investigation, just asking, who am I? Am I this? Am I that? Am I a collection of the entire five aggregates? Who am I? Am I who that those other people say I am? Or am I, what do I think about myself? How have I defined myself my whole life? Or what assumptions do I make about myself? So I might feel regret or guilt about something, and then that thought pops into the mind, I'm a bad person, I'm hopeless, and then just using mindfulness to catch that and apply the wisdom, like, well, is that just questioning it? Is that true? And not self is profound as well. There's a really lovely discourse where somebody's asking the Buddha about what happens to an enlightened being, or what happens to the Tathagata after death. Does he exist? Does he not exist? Does he both exist and not exist? Does he neither exist nor not exist? And Tathagata just says that none of those questions are relevant. And so then he says, well, how does one understand that? So then the Buddha goes on to say, when you blow out a candle, where does the flame go? Does it go east? Does it go south? Does it go west? Does it go north? And of course, the questioner says, no, it doesn't go. And it's just simply termed as out. And the Buddha says, likewise, the Tathagata is simply termed as having gone out of samsara. And you can't say he exists, he doesn't exist. You can't say they don't exist, but everything that you could conceive them by has no longer applies. And then he goes on to say, there's a few verses, gathas after that. He ends by saying, the mind of the Tathagata is vast and deep, like the great ocean. And so I think it's helpful to be reminded of the profundity of the mind of the Buddha. And anatta is linked with that. And so we have Kanti Parami, of course, just the incredible patience just to keep going through the thick and thin. And when we cultivate the way, it's going through the ups and downs of life and having a framework, having the Dhamma to help us through, and using every experience as fertilizer, as grist for the mill. And it's, as His Holiness the Dalai Lama said, there's no quick, there's no easy. And so there might be a tendency, for example, in a 10-day retreat, to really want the mind to settle in a certain way. But it's just so important just to be able to take stock of where is that tree that we planted in its growth cycle right now, and just being able to just stand back and watch, and just to water it, throw on fertilizer when it needs it, pluck the weeds out when they need to be plucked. And it's a gradual path, gradual progress, gradual learning. We're learning all the way to the end of the path. So anyone who's not yet an arhat is classed as a learner. and only the arhat is the no more learner. And Kanti Parami also has that aspect of not getting angry and being able to just stand firm in situations that might test us or irritate us. I remember visiting my grandma, my dad's mother. She was 92, she's passed away now, but this is in 2007, and we were visiting her near my hometown. This is in going to Atascadero, the old folks' home there, and visiting. So we drove down from Bayagiri, and then we went into the city to have a picnic before we were going to go see my grandma. And so my parents bought some sandwiches, and they spread out a blanket, and we were just in a park having the meal. And this man looked like he was maybe homeless, walked by us, and though my dad was in a really good mood, and he smiled and said, "Hi," and then my dad said, "It's a beautiful day, isn't it?" And this guy looked over and said, "Yeah, but there's always going to be some jerk who ruins it for you." And so at first it was like, oh, that's really negative. Oh, that's too bad. But then I reflected on that after, that maybe we had just had an encounter with Manjushri Bodhisattva. It's actually, there's always one person in the monastery that, you know, no matter what the group is, there's always one person who's testing us. But they're our greatest teacher as well. So Kanti Parami. Then we have Satcha Parami, commitment to truth. And this is can be external as well, but also internal, an internal sense of being able to know where one is at and to be able to accurately report that to oneself. In the Buddha's teachings, he has a list of aspects of a great person, a Mahapurusa, and one of them is knowing where one is at, knowing one's limits. And so that's important, to be able to practice correctly, just knowing where one is at, knowing what one's limitations are, what practices one should be taking on, what practices one shouldn't be taking on. So there's many levels to Satcha Parami, and one of those is just the internal Satcha, internal truthfulness with ourselves. Then there's Adhitana Parami. This is a perfection of determination or resolution. And I like to think of that as just not giving up, just not turning back, not turning our backs on the practice, because it's easy after practicing for a long time to get inured, to forget why we came to the practice in the first place, why we came to the Dhamma in the first place. I can remember first going to Abhayagiri in 2001, and when I went there to live long term, after a few weeks, I made my first phone call home to my parents just to tell them how I was doing. So they were asking, "Oh, how is it there? What's it like?" And I said, the first thing I said was, "I feel like everybody here is my best friend." And it's helpful for me to recollect that, because of course that perception changed. But it's still useful to recollect that, because coming out of the world, it is really a dog-eat-dog world, and you know, not everybody's nice to each other. The things that happen in the monastery, the very worst things, the very worst interactions that happen in the monastery just pale in comparison to what's normal. And that's just so easy to forget, living in the monastery. Or keeping precepts long-term. It's like, keeping precepts for 10, 20 years. Oh, I might just, you know, digress a little bit, and we forget why we came to the precepts in the first place. in the Visuddhimagga, if a monk is going to disrobe, he's supposed to reflect on the initial aspiration, what brought one to the robes in the first place. And that's supposed to be an antidote to thoughts of disrobing. So Adhidhana can be making resolutions, like the Buddha making the Adhidhana to sit under the Bodhi tree until he realized enlightenment. But also, it is just following through, and that willingness to keep seeing a way forward. Then there's metta parami. This ties in with kanti, with patience. The last two paramitas, metta and upeka, supposedly are the most difficult to cultivate. And these are two of the Brahmaviharas. And metta is, again, coming back to, I don't hate myself. And that's really the beginning of metta, because it's non-ill will, non-hatred to oneself. And there's a mental principle whereby we tend to relate to other people the way we relate to ourselves. Actually, compassion can arise based on that thought as well, because if we see someone who's really harsh with people, really critical, we can almost be sure that that's how they're relating to themselves, and so we can give rise to compassion for them. And upeka, equanimity, the Buddha saying that the highest of the unconditioned is nibbana, but the closest conditioned thing to nibbana is equanimity. And so we can gain an intuitive sense of nibbana with our practice of equanimity. Just being unmoved, just being like the elements, being like earth, urine, excrement, or scented, nicely scented things falling on the earth is still just the earth. So being equanimous like the earth, and bringing that reflection into the heart. So these 10 paramitas are just a nice framework to recollect, to reflect on, let's say, as the retreat comes to its end. And just any circumstance in life can be used to cultivate paramita. And it's just so helpful to remember that the mind is difficult to train, the heart is difficult to train. It's a gradual path, it takes a long time, and the mind itself can seem like just a raging vortex of delusion. And we just have to do what we can in our cultivation to just take stock of ourselves, try to get into the center of that vortex and see things clearly. So I think all of us monastics benefited a lot from this retreat as well. And I certainly had a nice retreat, and there's still a little while to go, and I wish everyone great peace and happiness. I'll leave it there.